Sunstone presents Patriarchal Priesthood, Gender, Priesthood, and Godhood. Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
We'd like to welcome you to this session of the symposium. I'd like to remind everybody that we are here by admission, as indicated by your tag, and if you haven't taken care of that responsibility, we'd appreciate that in the foyer. We'd also like to remind everybody that this session is being taped, and that tape will be available afterwards in the lobby once again. The topic of this presentation is entitled Patriarchal Priesthood, Gender, Priesthood, and Godhood. As the title indicates, it's going to address the subjects of the priesthood, the role now, the role possibly in the future, as it has to do with gender. I think it'll be very interesting. There is a slight correction in the program that you have. Those presenting the paper, David and Susan Hatch, are no longer located in Oregon, but they've come to us from Chicago now. David is a fellow in pediatric urology at the Children's Memorial Hospital in Chicago. After their 30-minute presentation, we will have some brief comments from Linda Newell, who is the co-author of a recent book, Mormon Enigma, and also the co-editor of Dialogue. Afterwards, with time available, we will field questions from the audience, and we'll proceed as outlined.
Although many theocracies have questioned traditional assumptions about women and have found it desirable or at least acceptable to ordain women to the priesthood, other faiths have insisted that such inclusion defies traditional and scriptural precedent and is thus against the will of God. The recent revelation sustained by the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints directing the ordination of women to priesthood offices has prompted discussion among Mormons. However, the official position of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints remains that by divine fiat, the priesthood is conferred on the man. Although the relationship of women to priesthood has been discussed in independent Mormon writings for many years, official acknowledgement of the question of female ordination has recently been given in a general women's meeting. It is interesting to note that this address, while upholding the present exclusion of women from priesthood office, did not rule out the possibility of future female ordination. Several authors, exploring Old Testament, New Testament, and Book of Mormon history, have documented the inclusion of women in certain priesthood roles. Six women are referred to as prophetesses. Of these, Deborah is portrayed as being most like her male counterparts. She is depicted as a judge, a revelator, and a national leader. Miriam occupies an important position in the Mosaic priesthood period, and she holds a secondary power, and her influence is principally over women, a position more compatible with Jewish tradition. Huldah gives a brief appearance as revealer of God's will. The prophetess Anna confirmed Christ's divinity, but we see no theocratic role played by her. The wives of Isaiah and Ezekiel are also called prophetesses, but no primary prophetic role is documented for either of these women. The canon, therefore, has been used both to advocate and also to oppose the inclusion of women in the priesthood. After the restoration of priesthoods through Joseph Smith, many Mormon women accepted and employed powers traditionally associated with the priesthood: blessing, healing, authority, governance, and the performing of sacred ordinances. Recently, the official position of the Church has been that such acts were performed by great faith and not through the exercise of conferred priesthood power. During the last 5 decades, women have been discouraged even from appearing to perform certain priesthood functions. However, historical analyses, by establishing that Joseph Smith, the ultimate authority on Restoration Theology approved of female participation in blessing, healing, washing, and anointing, and in fact included Emma in an order of the priesthood, have contrasted current church policy with its former procedures. Some authors suggest that the change has been costly to both men and women, and they advocate a return to former policy. However, retrenchment is not the only possibility. Believing that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints alone possesses God's revealed priesthood, Mormons have not traditionally thought of themselves as being capable of altering official church position. Priesthood, in the context of modern Mormonism, is a power held not by a minority of ministering leaders, but by most men, whether they are in official leadership positions or not. In other faiths, female ordination has placed women in ministerial roles without necessarily altering the offices of the ministry. Female pastors can function within the pre-existing system. However, the Mormon concept of priesthood underlies not only a broadly inclusive lay church organization, but also unique definitions of God, family, and the ultimate potential of humanity. Therefore, the effects of a change in ordination practice would likely be exponentially greater for Mormons than for other churches. What is priesthood? Apologists for the ordination of women in the Mormon Church have usually referred to priesthood as a presiding or administrative order, an endowment of supernatural blessing powers from God, the authority to perform sacramental ordinances, and a special power to receive and dispense knowledge from God. However, there are other powers associated with the priesthood. The Pentateuch describes a priesthood of governing, revelatory, intercessory, and ceremonial responsibility. Requisite ordinances such as circumcision and sacrifice, as well as the sacred custodial duties of the tabernacle, were performed by male Levites. The Gospels depict a priesthood of leadership and blessing with the powers of prophecy, baptism, healing, the casting out of devils, and even the returning of the dead to life. The Book of Mormon illustrates a priesthood of revelatory, sacramental, healing, intercessory, and governing functions. Perhaps the richest exposition of the facets of the priesthood was given through Joseph Smith in the Doctrine and Covenants. Here, priesthood is defined as a power of ordinances, of knowledge, of restoration, of sealing, of angelic ministration, of the establishment of Zion, and the power of God unto salvation. Joseph Smith equated the priesthood with the powers of heaven and specified that it was an everlasting legacy of God's kingdom and powers given to righteous heirs. Brigham Young documented the existence of certain priesthood powers not yet given to the church, such as the authority and power to resurrect and create. Viewed from this perspective, then, priesthood has undergone an evolution as man has progressed and regressed in order that God might effectively deal with mortals at various stages of knowledge and ability. The statements of Spencer Kimball indicate that this evolution is not yet complete. During this evolution, the qualifications for priesthood have varied. Under the Mosaic Law, only male Levites held the priesthood. The Gospels document the dispensation of priesthood to non-Levite males and Gentiles. While the Book of Mormon is not specific on the subject, we have no evidence that the priesthood was held by more than a select group of leaders. In the 19th century, Joseph Smith conferred priesthood more broadly on worthy males. The policy was later revised to restrict such ordination only to worthy non-black males. Since 1978, the criteria of race has been out of force. There appears to be a trend toward the dispensation of priesthood to a widening body of individuals. Will the trend of expanding ordination proceed toward the inclusion of women? Speaking in the simplest terms, one might say either that women will be ordained or that women will never be ordained to the priesthood. However, such ideation excludes a wide spectrum of possibilities. One's philosophy regarding the ordination of women is influenced by how one defines priesthood. If one views the priesthood as a group of men in leadership positions, then the ordination of women may appear to be impossible. However, the current expression of priesthood in Mormon theocracy may not be equivalent to the priesthood which Mormon doctrine ultimately proposes for its followers.
Mormons traditionally speak of the priesthood in two divisions, the Aaronic or preparatory priesthood of outward ordinances and the Melchizedek priesthood of presiding and spiritual power. However, Joseph Smith spoke of another priesthood as the patriarchal priesthood. He mentioned this priesthood in connection with temple ordinances in an address given on August 27, 1843. I quote, "Salvation could not come to the world without the mediation of Jesus Christ. How shall God come to the rescue of this generation? He will send Elijah the prophet. The law revealed to Moses in Horeb never was revealed to the children of Israel as a nation. Elijah shall reveal the covenants to seal the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers. The anointing and sealing is to be called, elected, and made sure. The second priesthood is patriarchal authority. Go to and finish the temple, and God will fill it with power, and you will then receive more knowledge concerning this priesthood." Joseph Smith made mention of the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods at this time, but he also referred to a separate patriarchal authority brought by Elijah, revealed in the temple, received by covenant, and associated with the salvation of the world through Jesus Christ. The revelation of a priesthood by Elijah was foretold by Moroni. The purpose of this revelation was to, quote, "plant in the hearts of the children the promises made to the fathers, and the hearts of the children shall turn to their fathers," end quote. The importance of this revelation of priesthood is evident in the verse which follows. "If it were not so, the whole earth would be utterly wasted at his coming." This prophecy, quoted seven times in the canon, preceded the restoration of both the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods, but it did not refer to either priesthood. This third crucial priesthood was to be revealed not by John the Baptist, nor by Peter, James, and John, but by Elijah. In 1841, 12 years following the restoration of the Aaronic priesthood by John, Joseph Smith was instructed that, quote, "there was not a place found on the earth that God may come to and restore that which was lost, even the fullness of the priesthood," end quote. This 124th section of the Doctrine and Covenants deals primarily with baptism for the dead. 18 months later, however, in an epistle to church members in Nauvoo giving further directions on the proper mode of such baptism, Joseph Smith quoted, "For I am about to restore many things to the earth pertaining to the priesthood, saith the Lord of hosts." Baptisms for the dead had already been performed at the writing of this epistle. 1 week later, he wrote another epistle of instruction on baptism for the dead. Here, he mentioned the prophecy of the coming of Elijah, and after expounding on baptism in the Nauvoo Temple, he alluded to other things which never have been revealed from the foundation of the world, but have been kept hid from the wise and prudent. Clearly, he referred to additional knowledge, blessings, powers, and authority connected to the temple and revealed by Elijah. In May 1843, Joseph Smith taught the necessity of the new and everlasting covenant of marriage as an order of the priesthood. 2 months later, a revelation was recorded setting forth the doctrine of celestial marriage. Such marriages were to be performed only by one holding the power of a sealing priesthood. This priesthood order was not to be entered into by individuals, but by married couples. Following a washing, anointing, and endowment received by both sexes, this priesthood order of exaltation and creation, the patriarchal priesthood revealed by Elijah, was given to women and men together. Induction into the order qualified them to inherit thrones, kingdoms, principalities, and powers and dominions, and to pass by the angels and the gods which are set there to their exaltation and glory in all things, which glory shall be a fullness and a continuation of the seeds forever and ever, quoting from the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Current usage of the term patriarchal makes the suggestion that women might receive the patriarchal priesthood seem irreconcilable. Because this term has come to symbolize female exclusion or subordination, it may be difficult for some to consider a use of the word without distasteful connotations. However, in a blessing to his father, Joseph Smith declared that his mother was to receive jointly all the blessings of the patriarchal priesthood. Joseph Smith also taught that patriarchal priesthood was held by Adam. Spencer Kimball emphasized that the name Adam refers both to husband and wife. This union was the Adam which held the patriarchal priesthood, a deifying order leading to the exaltation and continuation of the lives, because no single individual could enter into that order of the priesthood. In the King Follett sermon, Joseph Smith unleashed the revolutionary idea that man could follow deity into a condition of godhood. This, of course, is the express purpose of the ordinances of endowment and sealing. One reason that Mormon women are concerned about their participation in the priesthood may be that they recognize an intimate connection between priesthood and godhood. Godhood without priesthood would be only a limited godhood, which some have suggested is the ultimate fate of queens, priestesses, and goddesses. Joseph Smith gave indirect evidence for the full inclusion of both sexes in the patriarchal priesthood by insisting that Elohim, the name traditionally given to represent the Father, is plural both in form and intent. Perhaps we should re-examine our custom of referring to and thinking of God only as a singular Father, if we are to accept the eternal nature of marriage in the patriarchal priesthood and the ultimate potential of celestial unions. Then God must refer to heavenly parents. This, of course, is not consistent with the present forms of our theocracy, scriptural interpretation, or pronoun usage. On the surface, the concepts of God as parents and the inclusion of women in a patriarchal priesthood may appear to be inadequate compensation for the exclusive gender roles officially espoused by our society. For some women, the creation of one flesh through celestial marriage has traditionally meant being swallowed up in a male flesh. Although women are promised the full blessings of the priesthood, such blessings are thought to be held in trust by priesthood-holding husbands. Traditionally, the concept of a mother in heaven has included her consignment to such a dependent position. She has been depicted as a being who is pursuing the ultimate female role while remaining in the background. However, a careful reading of the blessings given to those who receive the quintessential ordinance of the patriarchal priesthood does not justify such gender divisions. In the following verses, the antecedent to which the plural pronoun refers is not men, it is both husband and wife. Quoting from Doctrine and Covenants 132, "Then shall they be gods, because they have no end. Therefore shall they be from everlasting to everlasting, because they continue. Then shall they be above all, because all things are subject unto them. Then shall they be gods, because they have all power, and the angels are subject unto them. For straight is the gate, and narrow the way, that leadeth unto the exaltation and continuation of the lives. And few there be that find it, because ye receive me not in the world, neither do ye know me. But if ye receive me in the world, then shall ye know me, and shall receive your exaltation, that where I am, ye shall be also. This is eternal lives, to know the only wise and true God." These blessings are not just to be given equally to individual males and females. Rather, they are bestowed upon a celestial union, the integer of the patriarchal priesthood. No distinction between gods and goddesses is made. No justification to view one partner as primary beneficiary or trustee is given. These verses also proclaim the necessity of receiving and knowing God. The God Mormons traditionally know is male, and although he is not single, he certainly appears to act singly. And yet, this God exhorts his offspring to follow deity into exaltation and a continuation of the lives by joining together in the celestial order of the patriarchal priesthood, thus becoming one flesh. Truly, we do not know God. Perhaps we refuse to receive a God indivisible into gender traits. The characteristics of a compound cannot be fully appreciated when the compound is always viewed from the bias of its complement atoms, rather than from the perspective of the entire molecule. We may well be preventing ourselves from knowing and receiving deity by refusing to perceive God as anything more than the sum of submolecular particles, exclusively female heavenly mother or male heavenly father. Some seem to suggest that the remedy for so many centuries of viewing God only as Father in heaven is in concentrating on God as Mother in heaven. Viewing gender with an egocentric and myopically mortal perspective, we may assign to a Heavenly Mother traits that are unique to the human experience. Some Mormons seek a lost or hidden parent who might come in power to bring peace and understanding to the world. Some seek an eternal homemaker, specializing in the decor of the earth, the nurturing, forgiving, and tempering of humanity, the all-accepting, peaceful parent. Some would arbitrarily assign to her a gestational reproductive stewardship. If we attempt to understand and develop the full potentials of women by exploring qualities unique to a female God, we may actually become ensnared in limiting gender definitions. The pursuit of a Heavenly Mother as a distinct being possessing characteristics unique to her gender may not be the pursuit of God. We are not justified in assuming that only one heavenly parent is receiving and responding to prayers merely because we have customarily addressed prayers only to our Father. We may have concluded that the Mother in heaven is kept in the background, subjugated by the Father because, by tradition, we have not acknowledged her ubiquitous contribution to the creation, sustenance, salvation, and endowment of the children she and the Father share. In searching for a signature on her works, perhaps we have failed to recognize their signature on all creation. Our tendency to segregate does not diminish God. It may, however, prevent us from knowing and receiving God. With this foundation, questions about the relationship of women and men to the priesthood may have more meaning. Women are not ordained to our present position. Mormons are exploring the possible ordination of women to the priesthood. Some are advocating such ordination. To which priesthood would they be ordained? Do Mormon women seek a priesthood of admission into the inner court of the tabernacle, of governance, of ordinances, of blessing and healing, or of knowledge? The reception of priesthood by women could take any one of a number of forms. Women might be ordained to a unique and separate priesthood. Such a change could represent a return to former policy. While a separate priesthood would restore to women divine powers and a degree of autonomy, it would probably leave women in a subordinate position, holders of a lesser priesthood ultimately controlled by men. On the other hand, women might be assimilated into the present priesthood forms. However, because the broad concept of priesthood in Mormonism is fundamental to so much of Mormon theology and practice, such an integration would require significant alteration in present priesthood forms. Alternately, both women and men might recognize and employ the endowment of the patriarchal priesthood. Despite the fact that Mormons hold that the family is the basic unit of the church, the organization of the church is in reality based on priesthood quorums. Every church member, male and female, is assigned to one of the Melchizedek priesthood quorums for the purposes of home teaching and correlation with ward leaders. All ward organizations are said to function to support the priesthood and are, in turn, directed by priesthood leaders. In practice, this arrangement can be a divisive force in families. Members of bishoprics, stake presidencies, high council members, quorum presidencies, auxiliary presidencies, home teachers, and visiting teachers must divide their time between church responsibilities and family responsibilities. Ordaining women to a separate priesthood or including women in the present priesthood organization would not alter this divisive tendency. However, if church and priesthood organization were based on families, the functioning of the church might serve to enhance family unity. For example, the pastoral responsibilities of the church might be divided among family units. A group of families could be assigned to one couple holding the patriarchal priesthood for the purposes now filled by the Relief Society and priesthood quorums. Several such groups might be presided over by another partnership. Wards and stakes might be presided over by couples sharing the responsibilities of leadership. It would be unreasonable to expect parents with young families and many home responsibilities to fill positions which require much time and energy. These demanding positions could be filled by members with fewer family responsibilities. Such a system could include single, divorced, and widowed members functioning within their own family units within the church organization. This arrangement would undoubtedly require a thorough reevaluation of the responsibilities which the church should assume. It would emphasize the primary importance of families in teaching and blessing. In presenting this paper, we have not intended to draft a detailed blueprint of the functioning of the patriarchal priesthood. In our brief rendering, we have attempted to advocate an investigation into this third priesthood and to stimulate the thoughtful questioning which is prerequisite to revelation. Although the scriptural foundation is clear, there is little historical precedent to support this interpretation of patriarchal priesthood. In fact, the early church practice of plural marriage contradicts the idea of a priesthood based on an equal union of woman and man. However, the absence of historical precedent should not prevent us from seeking a higher priesthood order. We advocate the ordination of women to a priesthood of revelation and knowledge, of blessing, of power, of ordinances, of creation and resurrection, of sealing, of love, of salvation and exaltation, in some, of deity. Neither women nor men can receive that priesthood while we insist on dismembering God into gendered parts. Rather than envisioning a time when female bishops will gather with new mothers before congregations to give names to infants while fathers sit in the pews, we must realize a world where celestial unions, both female and male, will exercise a jointly endowed priesthood within their own homes, as some now do, to bless their infants and to heal their children, where church organization will not be based on priesthood quorums, but on families, where women and men sealed to the quintessential priesthood power and office will fuse individual strengths synergistically to bless, to heal, to teach, to create, and to follow the example of the heavenly parents. As we speak of and to God as our heavenly parents, and not only as our Father or Mother in heaven, and as we cease to think of priesthood only in preparatory forms, we may qualify for a new dispensation of knowledge and power.
I'm going to begin with an apology, which I don't like to do, and I don't like to listen to them when other people do. But through a mix-up with Sunstone, I did not get this paper until very late. I did have it a couple of days ago, but by then there were so many other things going on that I really didn't have time to adequately go to the library and do some of the things with it that I think it deserves, and to make the kind of comment that I think the thoughtful presentation that the Hatches have put together truly deserves. But I do have a few comments and perhaps can share with you some of my own feelings and insights around the issues that are raised with this. And then I think that it would be very productive to have you participate in some questions and answers with the Hatches and perhaps with me. Excuse me. I really thought I could see this without my glasses. I wrote big so I could, and then I couldn't see it. Today the Hatches have explored two issues, women in the priesthood and the concept of a female deity, that have in the past few years moved to center stage in discussions among Mormons. They surfaced in independent Mormon publications, in a variety of public forums like the Sunstone Symposium, in smaller and more intimate circles of friends and kindred spirits, and I suspect, though I certainly am not privy to them, even in the meetings and conversations among brethren who reside in the offices on South Temple. And those I don't think are discussing changes of policy, but how to do with the problem that's arising from our discussing the changes in policy. But as the discussions proliferate, the inevitable divergence of viewpoints move in and out of focus. This paper today presents another variation on a now familiar theme. And perhaps here at the outset of my remarks, I should express my uneasiness with what I see as a layered process of research, evaluation, and conclusions. And I see this happening in a lot of areas as articles are published by people who have gone into archives and done primary source research and then choose from that research what is relevant to what to the topic that they are considering. By this, I don't mean that they go in with a preconceived idea and decide to choose those things which support that idea, although I do see some of that too. And I can speak for myself, since my own research into this area started about 8 years ago before there was before anything really had been published on it, and I ended up publishing simultaneously with several other people, including the Margaret Toscano and Tony Hutchinson, and then we have gone on to develop more variants on our own themes. But I know what I went through for my sources to get those, and I know that I did not start out with a preconceived idea that I was going to go in and prove somehow that women should be ordained to the priesthood and then lay out a plan as to how that should be done. But I found in other historical research places where in our early church history where women were doing things that they simply did not do, were not doing today, and I wondered why. And my innate inquisitiveness has led me into many directions. And this one led me into a very intense search for all the sources that I could find historically on women in the priesthood, at the same time being in contact with women like Melody Charles, who had a divinity degree from Harvard and knew the scriptures far better than I did, and discussing with her what the scriptural and theological implications for some of these things that I was finding historically, what they really were. And then went on to even to discuss further with Meg Wheatley, an organizational developer, on how these things would impact a church today. So it was not lightly or with preconceived ideas that I or most of the people that have, including the Hatches, I'm sure, have begun their search into this. But I was surprised where I came out, and sometimes I would come out with no conclusions and just more questions. But what I'm seeing happening now, and this is the case with the Hatches paper, and that is that that they have a good, solid secondary source bibliography within the notes of this paper, but not a single primary source. And what's happening is that they're taking that we, and I'm not saying they specifically, but I'm seeing over and over people taking other articles based on primary source material and building on that and drawing conclusions from the earlier conclusions and meshing them with others and coming out with things that may not have as clear a foundation as they should. And what I would like to have done was to have taken each of the quotes in this paper and gone back to the source they quoted and then gone back to their sources to see what they may have been missing in the nuances of the original source, that because of the choices that each author makes were included in those first published kinds of things. So it's with caution that I think we need to approach all of this, but at the same time, I have to say that I think it's healthy to do the kinds of speculating and to open us up to the new kinds of ideas that the Hatches have opened us up today. To move us sometimes out of a preconceived mold of what exactly we are caught in some of these issues that we're in which we're uncomfortable. And women in the priesthood certainly is one of those. And I think that there are a variety of ways that we can go, and I certainly think that having the Hatches alert us to the fact that we don't have to necessarily think within the framework that we have now, that there may be historical precedents, there may be theological precedents, and scriptural precedents for opening up to the idea that we do belong to a church that believes in continuing revelation and that things do change in it. And I've been repeat, I've often repeated the little saying that goes around in Mormon circles that change comes in two ways in the church, slowly and not at all, or not at all. And these changes do come often slowly, but we have to remember that Joseph Smith was an incredibly dynamic early leader of the church who stepped out of the normal frameworks of traditional Christianity to bring to us the foundations for the church that we have today and the practices that we have today. I'd like to comment just a little bit, since they mentioned the RLDS women in the priesthood. I think it was 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, that the revelation came to the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through their prophet and was given to their conference, which they meet twice a year rather than once a year as we do, that they should not be surprised should women be ordained. And the following year, women indeed were ordained to the priesthood. I don't know how many of you here had the privilege of sitting in the session that I did yesterday and listening to two of those women from the RLDS Church talk about how their ordinations came about and what it meant to them. The terminology is sometimes different. We have the same terminology that means different things in the two churches from time to time. But what was so impressive to me was the spirit in which those women accepted the call, totally that came to them unexpectedly. One woman knew ahead of time that she would have the call, and she could have been in any Relief Society ward along the Wasatch Front or from coast to coast. She could have been any Relief Society president. A dear, sweet, humble woman who was obviously efficient and caring and organized, but had a gift of the Spirit. And she talked about that. She talked about sitting in the auditorium at the end of the day, that evening, after the revelation had come, had been presented and passed by their church, and thanking God that she had been able to be part of that historical event, something that she had not thought about or considered for herself, and was particularly thrilled that the revelation included building a temple, and was promised God that she would do anything that he asked her to do in appreciation for that. And the impression came to her, the voice, whatever it is, that is personal revelation, will you be ordained? And it so stunned her that she had to ask again several times within the next couple of days, and never told anyone except her daughter, and was the first woman in her congregation in Colorado to be ordained to the priesthood. But to watch, to have them tell how they functioned in that, gave me real hope. As a husband and wife team, her husband as pastor of that congregation, going to the hospital and administering jointly to the sick. And what brought tears to my eyes, because this is one of my the things that I care about, is where she talked of in 2 weeks or 3 weeks hence, she and her husband together are going to bless their first grandson. And I have always felt quite comfortable with the idea that a child is conceived in love by both parents, and that the mother carries that child and gives birth to it, and that the father then gives the child the blessing. There's something very whole and complete about that for me, but the parts that are missing. Now the husband is in the delivery room. There is a bonding that we know takes place when that happens, between the husband and wife, when he coaches her through a pregnancy, coaches her particularly through the delivery, and is there to hold that baby and watch it come forth into the world. And I don't see any reason why that can't be completed in that circle where the mother is in the circle to bless the baby. I'm quite offended by the great crowd of men who gather around that infant, and the mother is setting, and I have seen mothers in my own ward leave in tears because they could not see or hear what was going on, either because of the crowd of men around the child, the location of the microphone, or somebody else's screaming kid, or even their own in the cedar row next to them. And I have shared with other RLDS friends and listened to them talk about some of their experiences in the home as they experimented, where each person in the room, when a baby was blessed, picked the child up and gave it an individual blessing. So I think, again, we can maybe somehow think of stepping out of what we're used to and looking at some other kinds of things. Even with the blessing of the babies, the words don't even have to change. If indeed women hold the priesthood with their husbands, as we're told they do, the husband still does not can say, by the power of the Melchizedek priesthood which we hold, and if he's really uncomfortable with that, he can say, which I hold. But I, at the same time, don't want to, while I can see there are many things that we can do in our church, that takes only a change in policy in the handbook, because it was changes in policy that took the kinds of things like washing and anointing and blessing away from women. It doesn't take a revelation to restore those. And I am pleased that Elder Hinckley, in his address to the women that Susan, the general women's meeting that Susan referred to, said not that men have to become mothers before women can have the priesthood, as we have heard in the past, but that it would take a revelation. And I, for one, believe in continuing revelation and hope that we can somehow, and I don't expect it to come sooner or anything else, but I think that if any time you double the talent pool of an organization, you've got something going for you for leadership in an organization. And I can see many, many ways that women can participate more fully in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints than they are today. And policy change is one, ordination is perhaps another one that I hope that will continue to be discussed. And now I think we could go to questions.
Second. question is, as an earlier panelist brought up the point that as long as priesthood is essentially viewed as managerial or primarily viewed as managerial, then women will not be participants. As women increase in their managerial skills, does that mean then that that's necessarily true? And can women be included in the present in the present priesthood without some major changes? What we tried to bring out in the paper is that unlike many other churches where the offices of the priesthood are pastoral primarily, in our church most men hold the priesthood, and priesthood is not just managerial, but those offices are very interpreted in our present society as being very closely related to certain positions and responsibilities which family members hold. Fathers do certain things, mothers do other things. Elders, quorum presidents, elders, 70s, high priests do certain things. Relief society presidents do other things. All those things are very tightly connected to how the church functions now. If women were to be included in the priesthood, then the questions of what is the purpose of the Relief Society, what would the Relief Society do, what do each of these particular priesthood offices that we have in the church today do? And we ask the question, can women be integrated into those offices without changing those offices?
Linda would like to make a comment on that question.
I was in a bishop's panel. Is this on? I was in a bishop's panel day before yesterday, where one of the men who had been a bishop three times said that the best way to do it is to turn it over to the Relief Society. They run the ward anyway, but just don't tell them that that's what you're doing. My mind just exploded in about six different directions, and one of the implications for that is that, yes, women are capable of being good managers. The other implication is, but let's not let them know because we're supposed to be better than they are. And then the other side of that coin is, and the argument that I hear and heard yesterday, as a matter of fact, by a very concerned sister, was that if women are given the priesthood, then will the men stop doing anything? And my answer to that is no. I think that men have a need for the same kinds of things that women do, and we have gone so far in separating out the male and female roles in our church that I think we're denying men their spirituality and their place and their commitment. And I don't think that that women participating in administrative roles in the church is going to affect the men at all. I really don't. I think that it will enrich the whole organization. I think that we have policy after policy after policy that are made because women don't sit on councils and say, hey, do you know what this is going to do to the children in the primary? Do you know what this is going to do to the women? Do you know what this is going to do to the elderly, to the widows, to all kinds of things? We need the input of both men and women at every level in this church. I really believe that. And as I said before, when you double the talent pool, you're going to go a lot farther.
Rather than giving ourselves track to the women,
Well, I think one of I'll
summarize that question. Are we misdirecting our efforts in women pursuing, per se, the Melchizedek priesthood rather than maybe focusing on a higher level?
That's what I think is important about the paper that the Hatches have given today, is that they have moved us in that direction today. But at the same time, the reality is that we do have an administrative church organization, and to let women do the work without the title is not any more fair than not letting them participate at all. I really don't think so. And while I applaud the many, many bishops that I know and have heard of who have included women, I remember when Jack was a young men's president, he tried like crazy to get a woman as his secretary in the young men's organization. And I think we have to, because she was the most qualified. And I think we have to continue to do those things and to involve each other as much as possible. But the fact is that there still is an equality in the way it's structured today.
Let's take our next question from this side.
Certainly. The question is that in the absence of policy, should we not go ahead and do those things which we feel good about, such as blessing a child in the home where others can participate? I feel perfectly comfortable with those kinds of things. But historically, I know that when people become aware that there is someone who's deviating from that very strict norm, questions get asked. Is this appropriate? Is it appropriate? And they will be asked until someone says no, and then there comes a directive from above and a stronger policy statement. And I'm very uncomfortable with that. That's one of the reasons why I feel like that a lot of the kinds of accommodations we make should be private. But at the same time, I like us to know about them, because I think they enrich and help each other. So there's a real dilemma there.
Let's take this question here.
For Susan or David, with regard to non-members standing in the circle for blessing their own children, which I've seen both in the mission field and in Utah multiple times, but yet women not invited to the same circle that non-members are. And secondly, the question about women performing ordinances of abortions and anointings.
The question regarded non-members participating in the blessing of children when women are excluded, and the second question regarded women performing ordinances in the temple. I assume you're referring to washing and anointings. And like many of you, we have resolved the first question by performing our blessings in the home where I could participate. And we went ahead and did that privately. And I agree with Linda. It's nice to know that other people are doing that so that we can explore those options. I'm very excited by the idea of women performing the ordinances in the temple. I think that women are given power in the temple ceremony, and I find that a very exhilarating thing, and I hope that we can. What we're trying to do in our presentation is to kind of expand on that idea and maybe explore some possibilities where women can continue to utilize that power.
One other comment I'd like to make on that, that policy changes periodically, and one of the problems we get into is trying to fit what we believe and what we know into a policy at a particular time, and that causes the questions about who should be in the circle and who should be doing what, and is it okay, and do we feel guilty about this? Are we justified in doing that? It's interesting to me, Joseph Fielding Smith, in his collection of books dealing with answers to gospel questions, addressed that, and his position on that was that there's no no reason that a mother shouldn't be in the circle. That's one policy at one particular time, and if we look at the relationship of men and women to priesthood and men and women to deity and try to fit it into policies that are present at a particular time, I think that causes a lot of the problems and the questions about this. That we can't have a more perfect situation with imperfect policies.
I'm afraid our time is spent. We'll take just one more question from the audience.
I have a question for you. I was intrigued by your speculation on possibly restructure of the organization and how to govern the church, which is something that I think needs to be said, because there's an awful lot of rhetoric bandied about the importance of the priesthood with spiritual power, but not really the real priesthood of the governing power. And you did it on the table, all the couples assigned instead of the forms.
We can take a short answer on this.
I think one of the problems in this, the question is, I'm having trouble consolidating the question. If we restructure the church to give power to people who don't have family responsibilities, and the church encourages people to have families, then are we taking power away from people who are doing what the church advocates? And one of the problems I see with the question of priesthood and what it is and what it should be is this idea of power. And is power or is priesthood office a reward? Is it an affirmation of one's acceptability to God? And I don't believe that church office or priesthood responsibility necessarily is a reward. I believe it can be rewarding, but I don't view it as a reward from God. The question we're asking in that speculation is just what responsibilities should the church assume? What kind of teaching should the church assume for itself, and what kind of teaching should the family assume? What kind of teaching responsibilities? What kinds of blessing responsibilities or service responsibilities should the church take within its organization, and what responsibilities should the family take? And the outgrowth of that is, should the church organization be a family organization so that church work, priesthood work, is not separate from family work or family responsibility?
Appreciate that very much. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but we do want to thank the Hatches for traveling here to present the paper and Linda Newell.